And now let's bring in our buddy Jay Billis, who was there last night in Indianapolis for an absolute classic in the national championship game. Jay joins us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, guys, and congratulations on the book. That's great.
Thank you. We're very excited, and we will have more on that later. But let's start. There are really two things that have emerged from the discussion this morning. You want to go into – which one do you want me to start with? I'm going to start with the historical implications.
No, let's start with Coach K. Let's not get in our feeble little argument first.
Okay. Let's start with Coach K, a man that you say you are – you famously say you are proud that you chose him before he became the somewhat iconic figure that he is today. He has won four national championships in an era where there is clearly – more good basketball, more good programs, more good players, more teams in the NCAA tournament, and a three-point shot that to some degree could be considered an equalizer for lesser teams to knock off better teams. So with all of that taken into consideration, what does last night's game do for Mike Krzyzewski's legacy as a coach?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think for those who are stuck on counting to determine greatness from one coach to another, it cements him as one of the greatest ever. I think he's one of the greatest coaches in the history of American sport, not just basketball. But I thought he was that before this. So it's a hard question to answer. I think he's one of the true greats and has shown it over the last 30 some years and the way he's handled everything that's come his way, whether it's in college basketball or USA basketball, you know, his Olympic gold medal. This is just one more accolade, one more time he climbed the top of the ladder and got to cut the Nets down. And he did it in a different way this year. His team played a different way. It was a different style. And I guess you could say it was a little bit like Wooden in that, you know, people say, well, you know, Wooden had Alcindor and Wooden had Walton, but Wooden won five of them without those guys, and he played every different style that you could play in order to win them. And I think Krzyzewski has done the same thing with the different teams that he's had in three different decades.
Well, the question Greeny's kind of asking is, at this point, is Mike Krzyzewski walking side by side with John Wooden, or is he a half step behind him or farther than that?
Mike, I tend to think that again, if you're counting, he's not even halfway to Wooden. I tend to think that 10 of them is a pretty big deal. And I think Wooden has done something that no other coach in any sport in college, I shouldn't say any sport, maybe Anson Dorrance or, you know, women's soccer, but certainly in football or basketball has been able to scratch. And to win 10 in 12 years, and I don't care whether the tournament was regional or it was 32 teams or they didn't have a shot clock or didn't have this, didn't have that, nobody can convince me that nobody could knock those guys off a little bit more often. They were just the dominant program, the dominant team, and he was the dominant coach. And until somebody does something closer to that, I think Wooden will have a special place in basketball history.
Mike, Jay Billis was there last night. We can't go anywhere else without taking a few minutes to talk about Butler and what they did, because unfortunately in sports, we seldom remember the loser. But certainly for this day, I think some celebration of what that program, that coach, those kids, that school accomplished, and to have been as close as they were and put together the run that they did, is something that needs to be celebrated. What would you say will be the legacy of these Butler Bulldogs?
Just a really fun team to watch and a good group of kids that played unbelievably hard. I thought defensively they were one of the best teams I've seen all year long. And they did something that was almost, they were right there to pull off one of the most memorable, championships in history. And I do think that this team will be remembered as a runner-up. But you can't say enough about what they did all year long and the way they did it, the way they conducted themselves, and especially their coach, the way he conducted himself. Just a remarkable group of people.
So then with 6 seconds to go, Butler, Hayward, the kid has a shot. Zubek is up pretty long there, make the shot arc a little bit. Did look like it was going in. It doesn't. Zubek gets a rebound, gets fouled. Shooting free throws with 3 seconds to go. Makes the first to put him up two, intentionally misses the second, so the clock starts on the rebound, and then we have the half-court shot. Your thought on the strategy at the end of the game?
You know, it's strategy that worked and can work and is certainly not a bad thing. I think there were a lot of eyebrows raised. Honestly, I was thinking when I watched it, did he just rock that free throw, or did he really try to miss it on purpose? Because you know, especially with your ability to foul. I've never been a big believer in taking any chance at all on letting somebody beat you. And if Zubek had tried to make the free throw and missed it, you're in the same place. If he makes it, the only thing that Butler can do is tie. So, I tend to think that making it was the probably the higher percentage play. And especially now, guys, you know, players practice half-court shots. And we saw Evan Turner hit a shot, you know, from about the spot that Gordon Hayward did. And, I mean, that thing, you guys saw it, that thing just about went in. And it looked good the whole way. So if that shot would have gone in, I think the Lucas Oil Stadium would still be loaded with people jumping up and down even right now.
Absolutely. And what you have been flying this morning and just got off a plane to call us, what you have missed is that Mike and I have been yelling at each other all morning long because Golic thinks it was the right thing
to
intentionally miss the free throw. And I am absolutely stupefied. Jay, is that the right word?
Is that a word?
Whatever. I'm dumbfounded by the decision. Coach K, I'm sitting here making an argument. He might be considered the greatest coach of all time. He has forgotten 8 million times more basketball than I'll ever know. But I cannot believe you would intentionally miss a free throw in that situation and give the other team a chance to beat you.
You know, and that's a fair point. I think the truth is, though, there's no absolute right answer. And that's why when you talk about being up three and fouling with a short clock, you know, some people say you automatically do it. There's no discussion, and that may work for your team. But, you know, we saw that earlier in the year where it's not an automatic. It's not like when you're, when you go for two in football just based upon the score, and you can have a little score sheet in your pocket and take a look at it and say, okay, here's where we go for two because this is what the score is. There are a lot of variables that go with that. And one of the things, you know, that when the free throw was missed, when Zubek intentionally missed that one, who's to say that he wouldn't have fouled Hayward when he went up to try to contest him putting the ball on the floor right away? You know, you put a lot of things at play. But you know what? It worked out. And I've always joked, you know, people say that the ultimate result is, validates the strategy. And I've always kind of joked, you can put a blindfold on and cross the highway and make it to the other side. It doesn't make a good strategy. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. And that one worked out for Duke. If that shot would have gone in, it would have been difficult to live down. But it worked out really well.
Yeah, blackjack is always the analogy that I use. You can do the wrong thing in blackjack and still wind up winning. It doesn't mean
nobody
that you said the right
nobody
thing.
Nobody said this was I still won't say it's the wrong thing.
I'm saying I'm arguing it was the wrong thing.
The strategy he imposed worked.
Well, the point is they had a huge advantage. There were very few ways that he was going to lose the game at that point. In my opinion,
that strategy
the decision
worked.
That was made was not the one. Not only wasn't the one I would have made, I can't even really understand.
Hopefully he'll retire from coaching now.
Golic, the argument that most coaches would make against your position, I'm not saying you're wrong. You could very well be right. And you'd certainly be right for your team. But the argument that most coaches would make is that if you make the free throw and then there's an inbound, you foul right away. And then you put yourself in a far better position to win. I think there were some other things that could have gone wrong, but percentage-wise, it certainly wasn't bad, but it did open up the chance of losing. And sometimes when you foul when you're up three, you do bring in the opportunity to lose rather than just have a team tie you with a. Let's put it this way: Gordon Hayward had that same shot. If Zubek makes the second free throw, that's probably the shot he gets to tie. Instead, he had that shot to win.
Jay's on my side. He's just too nice to say it to you. Jay Billis, you are the best. Thank you very
much. Jay.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys, and congrats again on the book.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Now let's go to a guy who was there, Tom Rinaldi, our ESPN reporter, whom I heard asking a question yesterday of Tiger Woods and did get 5 minutes with him a couple of weeks ago as well. Tom joins us from Augusta on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Tom, before anything else, give us a sense of what it was like in the room before Tiger walked in and after he walked out.
Hey, good morning, guys. It's good to be with you. It was a strange scene. I mean, it's difficult enough in some sense to be credentialed to the Masters. And then for the first time in my career, and I don't know if either of you has ever been in this situation, a ticket, an additional ticket beyond your credential was required to get into the press conference room. 206 of those tickets were issued. You had to be in there about 10 minutes prior. They opened the doors 45 minutes prior, almost like it was a performance. There were five cameras in there, and there was a camera that was about 5 feet away from him as he entered the room and made his way up to the podium there to essentially begin the press conference. It was very unusual.
Boy, sounds like the Willy Wonka situation. need that golden ticket. So when you interviewed him one-on-one and you saw how he was there a difference in how he seemed sitting up there in front of all the reporters?
I think he appeared more relaxed than he did in the five-minute session a couple of weeks back, guys. And I thought you made a great point there in the disconnect between at least the very small sampling that we just heard of people who called in versus the media's take on it. I guess a lot of that is based upon expectation. And, you know, certainly there were questions that we expected that he was going to be asked, some of which myself and Kelly Tillman from the Golf Channel asked a couple of weeks ago, and others that we simply didn't have time to ask. But I don't know that, and Tiger gave you a little more. There was a couple of news-making bullets, but beyond that, I think it was more about how he handled it as opposed to what he had to say.
Agreed. Mike and Tom Rinaldi, from a sports perspective, the real story here is the performance-enhancing drugs, which he has steadfastly denied, and he got into a rather lengthy description of exactly what he did do with Dr. Gallia and what he says he absolutely did not do. In your view, is there still a story there? Is that something people continue to follow? Because the rest of it, frankly, for those of us who cover sports, is really just a whole bunch of fluff.
Right, the blood spinning, which is what he went through with Dr. Gallia, and then, of course, the news that he had torn his Achilles and he was trying to come back from that. No one had any idea about that. And then the next step of what would make news, guys, is when he does meet with federal investigators. He pledged, in his words, quote-unquote, full cooperation with federal authorities when it comes to any questions they may have about Dr. Gallia. So when that happens, how he discloses it, what he has to say, himself, his camp, via any leak that might come from the federal side, that would be the next piece of news regarding that moving forward.
So the book is, that was the question. The book is still open then. You know, during this tournament, when he's after a round, when he sits in front of the media, the next tournament, when he sits in front of the media, are there still, outside of the HGH part of this and the Dr. Gallia, are there still going to be the Tiger Woods questions that we're seeing now?
I think the truthful answer to that is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because as this saga has unfolded, guys, there seems to have been a new definition of the bottom or the floor so often. By his own admission, he agreed with that. Just when he didn't think it could get any worse, it got worse. We don't know what more could come out that would again put the focus on his life outside the competitive venue versus what he's trying to do to win golf tournaments and major championships. He may have to react to those things if they come out. But yesterday, I think you guys would agree, was a really significant step for him in facing a full audience of media members sitting there for 34 minutes and answering their questions.
I do agree. I also think it was a significant day for him going to the first tee at Augusta and playing in front of people, albeit not nearly the size of the crowds that will be there on Thursday and certainly nowhere near the stakes that will be there on Thursday, but facing the quote-unquote public for the first time. How much of that did you see? And I guess there were two questions there. One, what did you actually see as far as his interaction with people and the way they treated him? And secondly, what, if anything, did you see in his game that you thought was significant?
I think this was really interesting and perhaps the most interesting part of yesterday in terms of Tiger Woods. There were several hundred people around the first tee when he made his way out. He got out there. Tiger really emphasized and stressed in the press conference his gratitude for the support that he received, which I found really interesting and perhaps speaks to his expectation as to how he was going to be received, what that reception might be. To me, I found his reception, certainly no one was castigating or negative or confrontational at all, but I found the atmosphere a little bit muted, certainly compared with what it has been in the past. When he walked up, for example, guys, to the ninth green, the gallery was huge, and even there, I thought as he made his way up the slope, up toward that green where guys putt balls over and over because it's a practice round, there was a smattering of applause, but never was there a roar. Never was there a prolonged period where people were clapping or doing anything that I think was comparable with the past. again, no one was negative per se, but I think that was very interesting considering how much that meant to him versus perhaps what it sounded like in the past. I think that's only going to grow going forward.
It's Tom Rinaldi live at Augusta with the inside story and what we saw and, I guess, on some level, what we didn't see from Tiger Woods yesterday. Tom, thank you so much for getting up early for us this morning. We appreciate it.
Guys, I just wanted to say Washington Road is available here for the next book tour stop, and there's a lot of fans down here. So you want to make your way down, we're ready.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
thank you. I tell you what, we give away more than 206 tickets. Anyone wanted to come sign to see get a copy of our book signed.
A Willy Wonka moment.
They'd be more than welcome to do it.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Let's go to Augusta, where Mike Tirico did his typical terrific job hosting SportsCenter's coverage of Tiger Woods' press conference yesterday. And so, Mike, after a day that you spent asking people what they thought of what they saw yesterday, let's ask you, what did you make of the scene yesterday at Augusta?
First, from Tiger's perspective, Mike, good morning. First step to trying to be a different guy. And look, people make mistakes, and then if they go through situations like rehab, they hope to come out a changed and better person. And you can't necessarily get all those answers in one day or one press conference, and especially with all the eyes on you. Tiger did interact with people more on the golf course. He did apologize over and over for the things he did and the people he hurt along the way. He was pretty contrite about it, and he's trying to go forward. Now, when will people accept and believe? That's an individual question. It's going to take a long time to answer. But what he did yesterday, I think, is the next natural step in trying to be just Tiger Woods, the golfer, and not Tiger Woods, the tabloid star.
Mike Tirico is with us from Augusta. How about the reaction that you saw from others around him? We had Tom Rinaldi on, who was able to walk the course with Tiger for portions of his practice round yesterday, played with Fred Couples, then a little bit with Jim Furyk. What did you see as far as the treatment, the reception that he got from the patrons there at the Masters?
Yeah, I was not where Tom was because where we had a host was a little bit different, so I didn't have as much access as Tom did. But the reaction I got as I was leaving yesterday, I was talking to some folks. The fans, I think, if you are coming to a golf tournament, you want to see golf. So unless you come with the premeditated intention, I'm going to come there and heckle this guy. If you're just coming to watch the golf tournament, especially people here, as you know, you've heard people talk about coming to the Masters. They wait years to do it, and sometimes practice rounds are all they get to. I know friends who are coming in today who've never been here who are dying to come here. If it's their one opportunity to come here, I don't think they're going to come here to boo Tiger or to heckle Tiger. So I think it's a little bit of a unique situation, which is why they designed to come back here at the Masters. So we're not going to know until the Players' Championship, Wachovia, the U.S. Open, on into the summer, how the general public reacts. Well, the people who I saw and talked to yesterday were kind of glad to see Tiger the golfer back, which doesn't necessarily mean that they say, okay, all is forgiven for what happened. We're coming to a golf course, and we want to see the best golfer of our lifetime since Jack Nicklaus perform. And that's, I think, the reaction you'll see as the week goes on.
Mike Tirico is with us live from Augusta. Going to put him on hold for a quick second, call him back on a different phone line, having a little bit of crackling. So we'll get that. And he brings up an interesting point there, Mike, and that is he handpicked this event to come back for because this event is different from others.
Right, it is.
As a consequence, that doesn't mean you're necessarily getting a true vision of what the future is going to be like for Tiger Woods from whatever it is that happens to him here at
Right. Augusta. But again, it's been calculated all along with him. And when you're in a position to calculate, I guess you can do that. And that's why he said in the press conference that he didn't play in Tavistock or Arnold Palmer Open because he didn't feel he was ready. He needed more time. Okay, I'm sure. Listen, he hasn't played yet, so I understand that. But also, I think it was very calculated he showed up at this tournament first because of the patrons instead of the fans and just the aura that the Masters is as opposed to a regular tournament.
Well, the controlled. I mean,
that's the word.
It is the most controlled environment he's ever going to be in. I actually have been reading stories here about how his security detail, what they're really concerned about is a stunt. What they're really, it's less about an attack of any kind is always your primary concern. But then beyond that, I think the concern is that there is a stunt that, you know, one of the quote unquote mistresses or someone posing as a mistress, I guess, potentially might try and jump out of the gallery and do something, you know, that would be attention gaining or attention seeking. So I think to some degree, that's one of the things they're keeping a close eye on. Now at the Masters, that might be close to impossible.
Yeah.
But as he goes on, that becomes a lot less impossible.
It absolutely does, but he gets this one under his belt. He answers the questions, and now the next step for him is getting out on the course. And again, will it be a different reception Thursday through Sunday than it was now? He also said he will be more approachable to fans. Did that mean Monday through Wednesday, but Thursday through Sunday, it is going to be the focus Tiger? And I have no problem with that. Listen, the guy has a way of doing business, and it's worked pretty well for him on the golf course.
Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio. Mike Tirico back with us now from Augusta. And Mike, how about the other players? We heard Tiger say how great it was to see the guys. He talked about the hugs that he got and other things like that. What reaction have you been hearing from players, I guess, throughout the experience, and what did you see yesterday there at Augusta?
I think they're glad to see him back for two reasons. One, they're sick of answering questions about when is he going to come back and what's it going to be like. And then secondly, and perhaps more importantly, I think in the back of their minds, they know that when Tiger's out here, sponsorship increases, viewership increases, fan interest increases, which means residually the money they can make out here, purses, endorsements, goes up as well. Remember, if you see Tiger playing and more people are watching, if you're in that last group with him, a lot more people see your company logo, and all of a sudden those sponsors feel really good about you. So if you are a player who, let's say, has the Mike and Mike logo on their bag or their hat, and you're playing around with Tiger, guess what? That logo's on more. That CEO feels a heck of a lot better about the Mike and Mike company. So it benefits you in the long run. So I think from a financial standpoint, they're happy. I think from a competition, because they want to beat the best. But I also think they're sick of answering questions. I do think there's a benefit for the other players in the field. Very few guys are being put under the microscope as you're expected to win here. The entire field, other than Tiger, is somewhat under the radar. That includes Mickelson. It includes Els, who's won twice this year. It includes Furyk, who's playing well. I think it benefits all those guys competition-wise trying to win a major this year.
So at the next tournament, when Tiger does his press conference, before the next tournament he's going to be in, whatever that is, are there the same barrage of questions, or do they take a different tact?
I think the barrage is a little bit less, Mike. I think it's a little bit more golf, but I think there are some folks who have questions that are unanswered until there's a final answer with this Anthony Galli, a guy, the doctor who they investigated, talked to A-Rod about. I think until you know if Tiger has talked to the federal investigators or not, that keeps coming up. I think the constant update on his relationship, whatever we decide as the media is our business or his business, I think those will keep coming up. But I think it will be less pointed and more toward three irons, five irons, why in the world did you play with a torn Achilles? How did you? How bad was it? Things like that. I think that's how it'll change the next month or so.
Mike and Mike, Mike Tirico's with us. Quickly, before we let you go, can we assume you watched the Duke Butler game last night?
Every second of it, on my feet, standing in the house we're staying at as that last shot was in the air.
Do you have an opinion? Mike and I have been debating back and forth on Greg Zubek intentionally missing
Brian
the
Zubek.
Free throw.
Oh,
excuse me, Brian Zubek intentionally missing the free throw on the final play. We have a difference of opinion on this. I will not influence your perspective by sharing that. Did you have an opinion on it one way or the other?
I don't think he missed it intentionally. That you need those points there desperately. I don't think he intended to miss that free throw.
See? Now, everything we're hearing is that he did.
Yes.
But and Mike Tirico is making that assumption because it would be completely nonsensical to miss the free throw when you could give yourself a three-point lead.
Yes, it would. The clock starts, you're dribbling up, you got a desperation shot. I have no problem with it.
How many of those shots have we seen go in these days? And how many times when people say, well, you're up three, just foul? We've seen that backfire on two different teams. So absolutely, he should have. If he missed it on purpose, it was a mistake. He should have tried to make it on purpose.
Thank you.
We will disagree then completely. I've seen a lot more of those shots missed than made. I'll tell you that much.
Hey, Golic, just remember this. Yeah. Non-athletes rule. We've been non-athletes longer than you've been an ex-athlete.
That's exactly right. And you know what? We always will be. Mike, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
See you guys. Have a great week.
See ya.
That's Mike Tirico with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline.
It's just non-athletes banding together against the profound athlete.
Listen, I mean, this is one where I'm really surprised that you're taking the other opinion, but maybe after 10 years, I shouldn't be so surprised.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Mike and Mike and John Clayton, the professor who takes us inside the huddle here on ESPN Radio to tell the world what's changed, and certainly the NFC East changed a good deal this week. We spent most of yesterday talking about the trade of Donovan McNabb from the Eagles to the Redskins. And so, John, let's pick up the conversation there, because clearly a lot of other dominoes will fall. Let's start with McNabb to the Redskins, your perspective, how it happened and what it means.
Well, basically, it just looks to me like there was very little else on the table that made any sense to the Eagles, and so they made a move that they felt they had to get rid of him, which, again, baffles me, because what they've done is now given three or four additional wins to the Redskins, putting them in a position now with Donovan McNabb to now challenge for the division lead, while in many ways what the Eagles are doing is regrouping under Kevin Cobb. And now you would have to think for the next several years, very much like we've seen in Minnesota now with Brett Favre this year and probably definitely last year, that now you give a franchise quarterback to an organization that wants to win and now has the quarterback that can help them to win. It's a baffling move, but still it's one that they felt they had to do to get Kevin Cobb as the starting quarterback in Philadelphia.
And again, reports are that the Skins and Donovan are working on a contract extension. You figure that was going to be part of the deal as well. It wasn't going to be one and done. So the quarterback that was there, Jason Campbell, but it was going to be an open competition. Now it's not. By the time training camp rolls around, is Campbell part of the Redskins or is he part of another organization?
I think he's going to be part of another organization, maybe even as quickly as before the draft, depending on how quickly they can put a trade together. You know, there is some initial interest, but still trying to see if Oakland is willing to make a move, Buffalo willing to make a move, maybe Carolina, whatever team. There could be as many as five teams in on this, but they may be in on this because of the cheap value of it. It may just be a fourth or a fifth round pick. Obviously, they're not going to get a second round pick for Jason Campbell. So in many ways, what Mike Shanahan is going to be doing in this one is accommodating Jason Campbell to at least try to find a new team and find it pretty quickly.
We already have seen the draft now will take on a different look. If Washington was thinking about a quarterback at four, they won't now. Looks like probably Russell Okung, the O-tackle from Oklahoma State, to fix that O-line. How about in St. Louis? Mark Bulger is cut. The 8.5 salary he had is gone. They did sign Feely to be quarterback. Any chance they would trade for Jason Campbell and go have a veteran in that sense, or is it completely open the door for Sam Bradford to be the top pick for the Rams?
No, I think it makes it so much easier now for them to select Sam Bradford, because at least they knew behind him at number four there was an owner that would have been willing to probably pay more than the first pick, if possible, had he fallen down. Now it's a matter, do you take Sam Bradford or not? Now the question becomes, can you get him signed before the draft? But I think that you can see now everything now is in place for the Rams to be able to take Bradford. He's had the good workout. He's been able to at least show that the arm is fine, the shoulder is fine, and now it's a matter to make sure that he's going to be fine being the number one pick in the draft. I think it's automatic now. I can't see anything changing before the draft.
All right, we both see that as well. But with the Redskins having addressed their quarterback situation, Mike and Mike with John Clayton with us here, assuming Bradford goes number one, and as you mentioned, Golic, I think the Redskins take the offensive tackle. What does this mean for Jimmy Clausen, who Mel Kiper actually has ranked as the number one quarterback in this draft? But you start to wonder, every year there's that one guy who kind of falls. Could this mean the potential for a fall for Jimmy Clausen?
I'd say there's the potential there, but I think there's enough stopping points to prevent it from being a long fall, because you start at each spot now, beginning at five with Kansas City, to see if, say, Charlie Weiss can talk Scott Pioli into it. If the answer is no there, then Pete Carroll will consider it at number five, at number six. Cleveland at number seven, Buffalo at number nine, Jacksonville at number 10, and I think the furthest he could fall down would be San Francisco at number 13, because what you're talking about still is the availability of a very good quarterback to come falling to you. It's just going to be a matter of which team's going to be able to take him. I think there's enough falling points to at least he's not going to fall too far.
Are there any other moves around the corner? You know, Brendan Marshall, Terrell Owens, some of the running backs that have been released, any moves that we can expect soon?
Soon, I think, is not going to be Brandon Marshall, but certainly one thing that I think certainly helps Seattle is the fact that Washington, for the most part, not having that second-round pick, is going to be in a more of a difficult spot to get Brandon Marshall. Still Seattle being the leading team for Brandon Marshall at the moment, but all they have to offer is the 60th pick in the draft, along with maybe some other draft choices. Still could be that the Broncos may decide not to trade him, but, you know, very much, I guess, if you want to move him, just like we saw with McNabb, something will happen. The one that's starting to become interesting is Albert Haynesworth, because Haynesworth was indeed offered to Philadelphia in that trade, and it does seem like there could be the possibility that the shopping of Haynesworth could continue. He's already been paid a lot of money, but he's a little bit more affordable if a team's going to step up. St. Louis could be interested, and don't be surprised if the possibility of Haynesworth going to Tennessee could be there. Believe me, those things are possible at this stage with Haynesworth at least being shopped.
Could you imagine Haynesworth going back to Tennessee, get his $100 million contract, and then a year later go back to the team where it began? John Clayton, Inside the Huddle, always the very best NFL insider information. Thank you, John.
Thanks.